Mikrobit.
Hello and welcome to the Mikrobits show. And today I have an exciting show for you. It's Nick Kunkel, who is coming to us from MakerDAO. And he's working on some very exciting projects there from a technical perspective. I think we'll definitely talk a little bit about oracles, which is really how information goes from off-chain to on-chain, and how we have confidence that that information is true, right? So, you know, typically in blockchain, you have strong on-chain proofs like proof of work or proof of stake. So you have these mechanisms that enable you to have confidence in the veracity of data, right? So obviously oracles, you don't necessarily know if the data is good or not. So I think that's really going to be, I think, a fascinating conversation. And of course, everybody knows Maker, and you know, it's a big, great organization. So, you know, I think it's terrific to hear from them. So just a quick note, this is a opinion and entertainment show. It is not intended to be investment advice. So, you know, anything we mention on this show should not be construed as investment advice. So, you know, I guess without further ado, Nick, how are you?
Awesome. Thank you for having me, Miko.
Yeah, this is very exciting. So, you know, I think the first place to start, I think we could just get straight into it, right? Which is, we always talk on this show about problems, you know, and how to solve problems, right? So I think it sounds like you've been doing a lot of thinking about oracles. So I would love to kind of have you define sort of the oracle problem or a problem that has to do with oracles. So jump right in.
Yeah, sure. Well, you kind of described it perfectly, right? You know, what are oracles, right? It's this mechanism for getting data from off of the blockchain onto the blockchain. You know, predominantly, those oracles are used for prices of things. And most of DeFi right now, right, is utilizing credit to some extent. Right, so you need to know the prices of things to know how much you should let someone borrow. You know, you need to know the prices of things to know when you need to liquidate, right, a position. So oracles are really critical infrastructure to the functioning of DeFi. So I think you kind of touched on one of the issues, which is how do you, as a user, trust the data that the oracle is showing. So that's, I think, one of the big problems. I think the other problem is cost, right? So how expensive is it to run an oracle? And I think you'll find that frequently you end up having to make a trade-off there, right? In terms of the security of the oracle versus the price. Not always, but frequently.
Wow. That's super interesting and an intriguing statement, right? Which is that there's a trade-off. So I guess just to kind of give a perverse example, like how could you make an oracle more reliable by spending more money? How does a slider work in this case?
Well, you could imagine the Miko ETH oracle.
Yes.
Right? And it's just you, Miko, are just pushing a price update you know, say once every, you know, half hour. And I think that's great. And now, right, but if I'm going to use the Miko ETH Oracle in Maker, right, I may be a little bit concerned, you know, the amount of influence that Miko has on Maker.
ETH, right? ETH, but ETH really is 25 cents right now.
Exactly, right?
Believe me.
So you can, instead of just saying Miko, it's like, well, you know, let's have a bunch of, you know, really influential and credible people, right, start to give the ETH price. And, you know, and then we'll take the median of that. So now I don't have to trust just you, Miko. You know, I can basically trust the common knowledge of a group of people. And so now I would argue that we've increased the security But in terms of the cost, like say we have 10 people in our group, we've also increased the cost by 10x.
I see. That makes perfect sense, right? And I think that the methodology that you're describing is very consistent with this entire concept of blockchain as defined by Satoshi Nakamoto, right? Which is that effectively, the blockchain has ways of arriving at consensus, right? And the question becomes like, what is the protocol for consensus, right? So in a sense, like when you talk about on-chain data, like transaction blocks and things, right, then you can have very strong cryptographic proofs, like proof of work, right? But it sounds to me like what you're saying is that, when you go from off-chain, and obviously, when you look at one information from one chain and you go to another chain, all of that is just off-chain, right? Like from the perspective of chain B, chain A is off-chain, right? So then the question becomes, and this is kind of stuff that comes up in the context of bridges and it comes up in the context of cross-chain atomic swaps and other mechanics. But like the thing that's interesting then becomes, there's a trade-off, right? So there's a trade-off between redundancy and kind of collective witnessing, right? So how many nodes and how many nodes are enough? So I'd love to kind of have your kind of take, because it sounds like you've been wrestling with this question from a technical perspective. So I'd love to get your insights about like, well, so how does this influence design decisions and how should people look at kind of the optimal decisions?
We started off with the naive solution, which is almost verbatim what we just talked about previously. Is, there's a set of people, and Miko says the price of ETH is this, and I say the price of ETH is this, and Kane and Robert Leshner and Hayden Adams, they say the price is this, and we take the median of that, and that was our oracle for
It's reasonable.
almost 2 years. We used that type of setup, and then gas prices kind of started to rise, and it's kind of you start to realize this is not a particularly sustainable, scalable solution. Right? So you look at, all right, well, what part about this is expensive? What makes it expensive? Well, the most expensive thing on the Ethereum blockchain is saving data to storage. So if you want to save the value of something, that's really expensive. So you want to minimize doing that.
Can you quickly pause for the audience's sake and describe kind of what is specifically the mechanism to store a state? Like what specific calls are you making in order to get the state reflected?
Well, just the saving, like if a contract has like a variable, right? Just saving a value to that variable is hugely expensive.
That's amazing.
So the idea of having, say 10 people or 12 people or whatever it is, have each saving this individual value, you can't scale that,
And
right?
it's expensive from a gas perspective, like it.
It's hugely expensive from a gas perspective.
Got it. That's fascinating.
So the optimization we made was saying that, well, the individual components that constitute the Oracle price, that those don't really matter. That the only value you really need is this final kind of value, right? This median value. And so all of this work that was being done before in a smart contract of, okay, go grab Miko's value, go grab, Robert's value, go grab Hayden's value, and then sort them, and then, right, take the median. All of that computation doesn't have to happen on chain anymore. It can all happen off chain. And the only thing you now need to prove is that calculation is kind of correct.
That's
So
fascinating.
the way that we kind of went about this was saying that if you are a data provider, like you are giving prices, you are not pushing an Ethereum transaction anymore. You're not pushing your data to the blockchain.
Yeah.
Instead, what you do is you just sign a message with that price.
Yep.
You're just saying, I am Miko, and for ETH, I think the price is, you know, $100 at this timestamp. And you basically broadcast this message to this kind of peer-to-peer network, which is, you can think of it like similar to a blockchain, but it's not a blockchain.
Got it. So this is really then just leveraging pure kind of basic cryptography and then pure kind of just internet protocol networks, right? So just really allowing machines to sort of freely intercommunicate and just using cryptography as a base.
Yeah, and so what's cool about this now is that it doesn't even have to be these data inputters that are sending the transaction to the smart contract now. Now anyone can actually be the one that updates the Oracle. So you've really decentralized this aspect of updating the Oracle, because anyone can be a part of this network where all of these price messages are floating around. And so if you want to update the Oracle, you can just grab all of those and send one transaction, right? And so now it's one transaction
Yep.
that sends all of that data instead of 10 individual ones.
Yeah, that's what makes it gigantic. I bet you can get, you know, several multiple orders of magnitude of improvement out of that kind of I guess shortcut.
Yeah, it was about a 15x improvement in terms of how expensive a transaction was.
That's terrific.
Because all you had to do on chain now was just look at all of the signatures and just verify that data corresponds to the signature and that the signers of those data are the entities that you trust.
Yeah, that's key. Some kind of like certification or some kind of mechanism that ensures that they're the right party. So, you know, I guess the thing that's fascinating to me is this is obviously this 15x, though, is multiplied against the sort of total number of feeds, right? So, you know, oracles have kind of like specific things like price feeds, right? So you may have like, I mean, potentially even thousands of feeds, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Astonishing. And what's the kind of state of this improvement? Is it production, or are you kind of playing with it, or what's the mindset?
So this has been a part of the Maker protocol since Multi-Collateral DAI launched about a year and a half ago. So we've been that's been kind of the cutting edge in oracles for a while. Actually, Chainlink just released their own implementation of this same type of architecture today.
That is fantastic. And it makes perfect sense, right? In a sense, yeah. The thing that's so interesting is that you're really kind of having to think about this as a major impedance problem, right? So in a sense, like, you have on-chain and off-chain. And so like the question then becomes, what's the optimal combination and when, right? Because obviously, like, you know, once you go on-chain, you have to really be doing it purposefully, right? You have to be like, well, why are we bringing this onto the chain? And it's sort of like, well, you have to do it at some point. You know, the question becomes when. So that makes a ton of sense. So with respect to kind of like, so this is a major transformation about the economic footprint of execution of Oracle. Like, you know, how do you see kind of this, you know, the future of the Oracle space? Like this to me, oracles are almost one of these kind of mostly unsung heroes that, you know, are probably responsible for like 90% of the value of something like DeFi. So I guess I'm curious what your views are on, you know, the future of this.
Well, I think the scope of oracles has been rather limited up until now.
Okay.
Right. You've only really seen Maker and Chainlink kind of push prices, mm-hmm. because that's kind of what customers wanted. That's what they needed. But I think that there is so much more that you can start to do with this, right? in DeFi, right, you're starting to see the emergence of like these insurance type of protocols.
Yes, that's big.
And a lot of it is kind of done off chain. But if you really want to make this permissionless, you need to start having kind of the risk models be on chain. And they're going to require a huge amount of data. So you really have to stop thinking about oracles in terms of just this will tell me what the price of something is, to this will give me any kind of data that I need to consume.
Yeah, I think in the case of insurance, it's typically almost like an actuarial model, and you just have like this incredible, potentially multiple inputs, right, into this kind of like overall risk model, right? That's kind of dynamic. So I guess for me, the insurance market is super interesting, and it definitely has tremendous room for improvement. So, what's your kind of take on DeFi insurance and, how you see that segment? Obviously we have the stalwarts like Nexus Mutual. I think there's plenty of room for improvements over that. We're seeing kind of more and more startups jumping in, so how would you see the insurance space?
I almost think like it's mispriced. And I'm not talking about from a token point of view. I'm talking about the rates for insuring yourself are something like 3% annually,
Yeah.
which given the yields that are generated in DeFi, is actually very reasonable, almost too reasonable.
Okay.
Because the risk, right, is quite significant, and it almost seems like they're either A, underpricing the risk, or B, intentionally making the premiums, underpriced to kind of gain market share.
Yeah, I think it makes perfect sense. I mean, one of the really crazy dynamics in the economy is sort of that a lot of these kind of constructs, even in DeFi, are kind of dependent on sort of a game of like, let's pretend, right? So, in a sense, like there's a very strong urge to kind of make the basis for economic activity sort of pretend, make believe game, right? So I guess it's interesting that you're kind of pointing at insurance. Obviously, the things that have yet to be kind of resolved at a large scale are kind of the incentive models within insurance. I think DeFi, I think self-insurance seems like a very sensible incentive model because obviously if your protocol fails, you really want to kind of like give your supporters the kind of backing that you want them to get. But like the question then becomes like, how do these kind of independent DeFi insurance providers, how does the incentive model work? Because in a sense, like they're optimally incentivized to like not pay, and ideally, their profit is dependent on paying as infrequently as possible and as little as possible in all cases, right? So I think it's a really interesting thing that's yet to be fully resolved. And I think that, it's interesting what you're pointing out, which is that, there's mispricing that, and it makes sense, an understatement of risk, which I think also makes sense.
Yeah, and I mean the other thing compared to traditional insurance models, right? Insurance companies get insurance too, right? Who insures the insurer,
I like
right?
that.
And you'll ultimately find that a lot of these guys are backed by like AIG or what used to be AIG, right? Or
Yes.
now it's mostly like Lloyd's. DeFi doesn't really have that, right?
Yeah.
Or at least if they've tried, Lloyd's has been like, we're not touching that, right? So.
There's been no FDIC either, which is another major insurer. So how do you see this, right? Because I think one of the things that's been really incredible is to see kind of the backstopping that's happening, right? So in 2008, we saw the collapse of Lehman Brothers and also the collapse of AIG, right? So, if you're insuring something like Lehman, like you're going to find it pretty hard to pay if Lehman just disappears in a crater and $600 billion of balance sheet goes to zero in an afternoon. So, I think that how should we be reasoning about, these types of concerns, especially in the DeFi segment?
I wish I had a good answer. maybe I would be out there building an insurance protocol, but no, I think the problems are twofold, right? Because a lot of the risk that these insurance companies are insuring, right, it's like hyper correlated, right? So because of the composable nature of DeFi, because everything is kind of tied together, it's very likely that something in one protocol affects something in another protocol. So the distribution, you know, the distribution of, you know, events is actually it's almost like super stacked, right?
Yeah.
And that's quite dangerous.
That is. I think you've got a really solid point there. And I think, you know, that is what we saw in traditional finance with AIG and Lehman and all these, right? Which is that the interconnectivity and the correlation of the assets effectively starts to kind of create a domino effect, right? So, you know, when you look at credit default swaps and CDOs and credit derivatives in the case of Lehman, you know, you really saw this multiplicative effect and these interdependencies. I mean, you know, to me, I'm very much kind of a proponent of this theory that, you know, that DeFi will at some point collapse as a whole, you know, and the question then becomes like, what are the sizes of the collapses and the timing of the collapses, you know, and the, you know, and I think the questions you're asking are very meaningful, which is, you know, what are the potential backstops and what are the potential mechanisms that can kind of enable it to, you know, do it in a much more functional way, right? You know, so for example, in the recent kind of ETH downturn, you know, we saw like a couple hundred million in liquidations here and there, you know, but like the system seems to have held up, right? But, you know, obviously, you know, there's shocks of different sizes and that one was not particularly large, you know, so it's interesting to kind of contemplate, you know, how to understand risk. So I guess my question to you broadly would be like, how do you understand, what is your way of modeling risk in the DeFi space?
Oh, okay. So for me, it's almost like composability is only ever talked about as a positive. And it
money Legos.
Composability is great, right? It's creates this kind of positive feedback loop that, you know, what's good for one protocol is good for many protocols, and you know, we've done an enormous amount of scaling based off composability. But it's also this double-edged sword in that the more interconnected we all are, the more we are kind of giving ourselves this Achilles heel. And so it's almost the irony is that you want to minimize the amount of protocols that your protocol integrates with.
Wow.
And at the core level, from a point of view of security, from a point of view of risk,
right? Attack surface.
You want to decrease your, exactly. You want to decrease your attack surface. And yet you want as many people to integrate on top of you so you get the scalability benefit.
Got it.
And it's kind of like a, you know, not me, but you. Which is quite self-serving.
Yeah. So it's basically everyone should depend on me, but I should not depend on anyone.
Exactly, right? You kind of want to be on the base, you know, you want to go lower down the stack and kind of assert yourself on this base layer. Which I don't think anyone is kind of, you know, playing games like that, but it's from a architectural point of view when you're designing a protocol. These are the types of things you think about, right? To reduce the risk exposure that your protocol has with something going wrong.
That's incredibly elegant, you know, and I think it makes a ton of sense, right? Because obviously, you know, the more dependencies that you have, right, the more surface that you have. And, you know, the thing that becomes interesting is that this kind of interactive effect, you know, has potentially exponentiality, right? So it may not even be an individual system that's vulnerable. It may be a unique combination of systems, as we've seen with things like flash lending, where we've just seen, you know, a unique combination of systems that seem to work in a way that's unexpected, right? And obviously, like, when you think about linearity and predictability, right? A lot of linearity and predictability is sort of range bound, right? Where it's sort of like, oh, well, this will work beautifully over X ranges. And then it's a kind of like, yeah, but what about if we exceed the range? You know, then what? So that's interesting.
And that's precisely kind of why I like have an enormous amount of respect for all of these kind of yield aggregator kind of projects, because they really have like this impossible task. Like it's like a where their protocol, right, it has to integrate with a bunch of different protocols, right? So you're to get the yield, right? So by definition, right, you are just exposing yourself to this huge attack surface and trying to reason about, you know, all the different ways that it can go wrong, right? And between like, you know, two protocols, you can be like, okay, if this, then that, how does that affect me? But when you have 3, 4, 5, it's just so complex to reason about. And so like, it's a, you know, when you see things like the yearned and hack happen, or like, you know, the Alpha Homora stuff with the Iron Bank, it's you know, a lot of people are giving the devs, you know, being like, oh, these are bad devs. Like, no, they're not. They're some of the best devs in the space. It's just they have this Herculean task that's I hate to say it this way, but it's not a matter of like if they'll get hacked, but when. Like it'll happen eventually.
Here's a question, right? Which is, it feels like one of the things that might be a potential way to mitigate this would be to have kind of like maybe like evolutionary yield strategies, you know, and to have some kind of an algorithmic or evolutionary sort of a, I guess, adversary, right? So you could potentially have, you know, because I think, you know, where my fund is invested in a company called Into the Block, and they do kind of algorithmic trading strategies, right? So the thing that becomes interesting in DeFi is like, what if there were kind of like evolutionary kind of mechanisms, right? Because then these evolutionary mechanisms could find all kinds of like novel ways to generate yield, right? And the novel yield generation strategies could definitely involve flash lending, or they could involve, you know, and in a sense, you would just kind of like, you know, just artificially select the ones that are producing yield, whether through, you know, but the thing that's interesting about a methodology like that is that that methodology would be almost like a chaos monkey, you know, only it would be kind of more goal directed, right? It wouldn't just be randomly unplugging systems and blowing them up. Like, you would actually be purposefully trying to suck yield out, you know, and, you know, sometimes you can evacuate yield through a mechanism that was not intended, right? You know, it's that's where the rub is.
Yeah, no, I think that the space, right, that was kind of previously occupied by Wealthfront, right, and those types of things, right?
Yeah.
Those algo investor type of platforms.
Yeah.
They're eventually just going to be either themselves, you know, become, you know, gateways to DeFi, or the DeFi guys will just kind of become them, you know, whichever happens first.
Yeah, I do think there's kind of a great opportunity for those types of things. Obviously, on-chain data as well as kind of contracts become transparent, right? So because those artifacts are transparent, then it means that they can be effectively sort of reasoned about by machine intelligences, right? And, you know, so to me, and the types of exploits that we're describing are not high level, they're low level, right? So, you know, what I mean is that, like, you know, that in a sense, this kind of like, it would just be this try hard bot, right? So the try hard bot would basically just try just every possible combinatoric, right? And it would sort of ask itself like, well, did I win or did I lose? You know, and then if you win, then you just reproduce that algorithm and you just keep trying, right? So it's kind of like, you know, the Google Go playing bot that plays itself, right? So in a sense, like, you could do something that's generative and adversarial, you know, and that might be a way to test pre-deployed contracts, and it, you know, and it may also be a way to, you know, so maybe there is eventually a way that we can create a test harness that's based on this kind of like attack monkey, you know. So it's maybe not a chaos monkey, but an attack monkey that kind of deliberately just tries to bash the hell out of everything. You know, not randomly, but to specifically extract alpha.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that kind of segues us into kind of talking about security.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, jump in. Security is huge.
It kind of bothers me that, you know, from a, both from a project point of view, but also from a user point of view, right? That it's kind of seen like, oh, well, we got an audit. Like it's safe, it's secure, right? And you know, it bothers me because from a user point of view, like, you should demand more, right? And if you don't demand more, then, you know, projects aren't going to give you more, right? You know, I guess it's what this kind of, you know, you vote with your wallet or with your clicks or with your attention, right?
Yes.
You know, audits are certainly a valuable piece of, you know, your kind of security strategy, but they can't be the only piece, right? You know, we so at Maker, you know, we've, you know, we had to, like, not just like one audit, you know, we had many audits, right? But we also did like bug bounties, right? Where I think at one point you could get like $1 million if you could steal any money from the system. And that's a significant amount of money, right? So, you know, some people balk at the cost of an audit being like 50K or 100K, right? But if you want some of the best talent, you know, some of the best talent doesn't even work at an auditing firm because they can make more money, you know, just collecting bounties or, you know, even just being a black hat or a gray hat.
Absolutely. And we've seen those, right? We've seen the exploits, we've seen the flash loans, we've seen all of them, and they they're doing very well for themselves.
Yeah, and then, I mean, you have things like formal verification, which, you know, also are kind of a meme, where I think formal verification can be really useful, but when you formally verify something, you are only proving your spec.
Yes. I that always bothered me. That always bothered me, right? Which is that people, the thing that's really bad is that that all mathematical systems kind of can be convergent and closed, right? Whereas all real world systems can be like divergent and open, right? So in a sense, like, you can prove that an actor would not in their self-interest ever do a certain thing in this game, but you can't ever actually prove what game any actor is playing, right? There's no mathematical way to prove that an actor is playing the game that you think they're playing, right? Like, there's just no proof, right? Like, people could be playing any game. They could be playing the Joker game where some people just want to see the world burn, right? So they may actually exhibit self-destructive behavior that's unexplainable. I mean, that's the Joker attack in a nutshell, but like, Or they could be playing a much larger game, and you just haven't understood the game that they're playing. So, like, you know,
it's... Exactly. So formal verification is one of those things that you can't just bolt on at the end. It's almost like you need to purpose build the architecture of your contracts to be easily formally verified, because only by doing it that way, can you ensure that there is a higher likelihood of synchronicity between your spec and your code, what you've actually built. If you don't design your smart contracts with formal verification in mind from the start, it is highly unlikely that your spec will reflect the end result of what you've built.
Yeah, of course. And that's a very deep insight. You know, my fund Gumi Cryptos is invested in Idle Finance, and they're actually one of the yield aggregators that you're describing. So, you know, I think it does produce like really interesting dynamics, right? Because obviously, you have to have a very strong mind towards understanding security. So in a sense, like you almost become a bit of an audit firm yourself, but like that doesn't even absolve you from these kind of combinatoric attacks, which I think you described, right? Which kind of approximate sort of almost boundless complexity if you continue, if you continue to persist. So those are fascinating problems to solve. So I guess, formal verification, notwithstanding, like what are your feelings about the state of kind of smart contract security? How do you feel about it? Do you feel like we're in the right paradigm? Right, because obviously one of the things that's so interesting about it is that we actually don't even have some of the basic security primitives that you have in boring software things like enterprise software. Like you don't have role-based permissions. Like there's just entire frameworks that are missing from the security model within, for example, Solidity. So what's your feeling about that?
Well, as you pointed out, right, there's a huge room for improvement, right, till we reach, what is just considered, kind of a standard in other industries. Now that being said, right, I do think that we take it seriously. It's just a matter of it does take time to build these tools and these extra layers. It's not that we've been ignorant or oblivious of it. It's just all of these things take time. DeFi didn't exist 3 years ago, right? So it's incredible to see, how quickly, DeFi has scaled in that time, right? And kind of created a market for these types of tools and for these types of services. So now that that market demand exists, and those things are being built, and those resources have been allocated, it's not here now, but it's just a matter of time, right?
I think you're right, but I think that it's fascinating to kind of contemplate the areas of security which could borrow from kind of regions of cybersecurity, right? So, for example, when you talk about things like your Oracle implementation and kind of how to design kind of pure cryptography and internet protocol utilization to kind of counterweight the on-chain expenses, especially of things like state persistence, right? So when you kind of like do these optimizations, the thing that I think is fascinating to contemplate is like if you look into traditional security paradigms, there are often things like role-based security and access, right? So in a sense, the thing that's so interesting is that when you look at the base layer abstraction of what happened with the Bitcoin white paper, what you have is you have this assumption of peer-to-peer, aka electronic cash, right? And so you don't actually have this idea that is inherently role-based, right? You have this kind of like assumed pseudonymity and equality, right? So in a sense, the thing that's so interesting about some of the assumptions is that the assumptions are that we don't ever know who any of the actors are, and we don't have any preferential treatment of any of the actors, right? But like, is that even necessarily sound? And like, obviously, I'm kind of now dabbling in the talk of centralization, which I think may be disturbing some people. But I would say that, like, should our system designs be completely divorced from the idea of roles, or completely divorced from the idea of like, authentication or role-based security?
No, I don't think they should be. I think a good example of this is kind of how admin type of functionality works in the Maker protocol, where the Maker Foundation itself, there's no like key or backdoor or anything that the foundation can actually control.
Ah, shoot.
It's all controlled by Maker governance,
Got it.
which is to say that to enact any changes in the system, token holders need to vote.
Yes.
Now, that is probably on the really far end of the scale, right, for decentralization. But in terms of coordination, right, the coordination penalty you pay to have every little tiny thing, right, have to be voted in by governance
Yes.
is huge, right? So you pay a penalty there in terms of in terms of, you know, the time it takes to change anything.
Yes.
So what we see now is kind of governance being like, well, this is a lot of overhead for us. We want to delegate some of this
Yes.
responsibility. And this is where it kind of goes back to what you were saying about roles, right?
Yes.
So what they're doing is just saying governance is basically saying, okay, you know, this team, right, is responsible for this part of the system, and they can enact any changes specifically to that part of the system. But there's a delay. And, you know, there's a, say, a 24-hour delay. So if they try to do anything bad or funny or something that governance is like, this is malicious, right? Governance can essentially stop that from action from taking place.
Wow, that's so cool. And I think to me, these optimizations are logical, right? Because the thing that's so funny, and I think even the existence of oracles to me is indicative of, I would call it the new pragmatism in DeFi, right? So, in a sense, most oracle or oracular paradigms are based on this idea of things like staking and slashing, right? So, in a sense, they're kind of game theoretical and they're not kind of thermodynamic. Kind of proofs, right? So they're much more kind of like, oh, well, a rational actor wouldn't do that. And it's like, okay, well, it's good enough for me, right? It's almost like the owner of the bridge will be penalized for a larger cost than all of the value of my trucks and all of the contain the freight inside of my trucks, right? So if the bridge owner causes the bridge to collapse with my trucks on it, I can just clearly see that that would be so bad for them, right? So in a sense, like it becomes almost a feeling of commerce, right? It becomes almost a feeling of like, well, okay, well, I'm just gonna do it then, right? Because it's like this seems fine, right? And so to me, the optimizations you're describing around this kind of like time machine thing, right? Of like, you know, just knock yourself out, but we're gonna like make sure that you don't, you know. And I think if you're caught doing kind of these naughty things, first of all, it won't work, right? Because your check-in isn't going to make it to the main net at all, right? And furthermore, like, you know, we're gonna come find you. You know, like we'll be really mad, you know. So I think those are all reasonable, right? Those are all reasonable ideas. And you know, some of the ideas, you know, end up kind of getting tied to is there like an identity concept in there or not? Like in the sense of like, you know, obviously the controllers of these, are they pseudonymous or anonymous, or are the developers known, right? Because those are all really interesting questions.
So they're public figures, and they're not even like necessarily employed by the foundation.
Yeah.
There are individuals that are just the community has employed, and the community is paying
But people can
from the
generally
fees.
find them, right? Yeah.
And these people are being paid by the fees that are generated by the Maker protocol. So it's
There's something gloriously traditional about some of this stuff, you know what I mean? Because like when I talk about them being very traditional, is that when you go back to, I read this book called Debt, the First 5,000 Years, and they talked about the securitization of debt, right? And you know, one of the things that happens with securitization is the depersonalization, right? Which allows for kind of this economic violence to be perpetrated. But the thing that's so funny about it is that at the end of the day, it kind of boils down to habeas corpus, which is sort of produce the body, right? And the thing that's so interesting is that since we're inside of bodies, right, it's possible to have this concept called debtor's prison, right? So in essence, what happens is that if you don't pay the debts, then we will like grab your physical presence and we'll like, you know, encapsulate you into like a prison, you know. So all of that sounds kind of like really, you know, traditional and kind of centralized, you know, because obviously when you think about decentralization, you know, one of the things that's kind of inescapable in decentralization is that like humans have bodies and the bodies are centralized, right? And decentralizing the bodies tends to have bad results for the individuals, right? And, you know, and this stuff all goes straight to the core of this whole endeavor, right? Because, you know, if you look at Satoshi, Satoshi solved the problem in his or her own way, right? Which is, yes, I'm probably a human. I probably have a body, but you just don't know where it is. And I that's how I want it to stay, right? So it's very interesting what you're describing, right? Because in a sense, we saw that in the kind of sushi situation, right? Which is you mm-hmm. saw Chef Nomi, and it's kind of like habeas corpus, right? It's like, you know, let's go get the guy. And it's like, who's the guy? Like, you know, it's yeah, there's no getting to be done here. It's kind of it's over before it even started, you know. Mm-hmm. Turned out okay though.
Yeah, turned out great, right? Actually it's been surprising the amount of times that that type of situation has unwound and turned out okay, right? There were a couple of high profile hacks, right, where the attacker ended up returning all of the money.
I just love that. It's so incredible. It's so incredible. And
I don't imagine it came from the bottom of their, you know, good hearts, right? It's probably someone kind of realized like, hey, I found you. Like, I know who you are. And it's like, oh, shit.
Doxing, right? Yeah. It's like there's at least one person that knows who this is. And it's sort of like, okay, you've been had, right? It's like... yeah, fix it or else. Yeah, it's fascinating. It's fascinating, right? Because at the end of the day, when you think about DeFi, right, it comes down, like, there's a big FI part to it, right? You know, like, that we all have to kind of really respect that part, the finance part, the part that, where it's like, you know, this is serious financial energy. And the question is, like, how are we behaving and how are we dealing with that? So, you know, these are really interesting answers and you know, very interesting to kind of contemplate the depths of these answers, because, you know, I think we're solving these fundamental problems, you know. So I think what's kind of next in your what's on your horizon? Like, what are you thinking about in terms of the future and, you know, big ideas, and, you know, how do you see this thing shaping up?
So I think I'm always a little bit biased towards DeFi, because that's kind of my interest. So I know that there's all kinds of stuff happening, right, with NFTs and sure. privacy. But for me, I'm always thinking of, like, what is holding DeFi back right now? Like, what primitive, if we had that, you know, would, like, you know, let us step it up to the next level? And it's not new. It's just not a solved problem. It's this idea of identity.
Yes. Right? Yes.
Once we have identity, right, we don't have to do this, you know, secured lending anymore, right? We can give under collateralized loans.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Which is really, if you think about banking in the real world, right, DeFi is very different. In DeFi, you are putting up your assets and you're borrowing against your assets, versus in the traditional lending world, it's mostly people, you know, using their proof of income and, you know, their built up kind of credit history, right? Their credit score to borrow. So they're fundamentally different. And, you know, we need to, like, you're not going to bank the unbanked by having them take out, you know, secured over collateral loans. You know, they don't have assets, or they don't have assets in the traditional sense. They're asset poor, but, you know, they're opportunity rich. And so like, if you really want to help, you know, bank the unbanked, and you want to be able to give them access to capital, right, to invest and grow and become the best version of themselves, we need to figure out identity.
Yeah, I love what you're saying, right? And obviously
identity will unlock credit scores, you know.
And yes, and there may be models like the Grameen Bank where there's kind of micro lending, and there may be models where there's sort of social pressures and there's groups and lending to groups and these kinds of, you know, so there may be, you know, models where we kind of, like, get that as an emergent property, you know, and possibly not completely disrupting pseudonymity or anonymity. But I love what you're saying. I think there's a kind of, it's an infinite well of goodness. I think there's tons of intellectual property to be mined out of that. So, you know, I definitely think that identity is a huge frontier. I think I touched it a little bit with this idea of role-based security, you know, but it's not just about security, right? It's but I think when we talk about risk and we talk about risk assets and we talk about collateralization and credit scores, like we're definitely getting there. We're getting towards a world where we kind of solve these problems in a really much more elegant way. And I think it's a bit of a third rail because DeFi has this kind of Satoshi vision in it, right? Which is this kind of presumed pseudonymity, anonymity, but like, you know, it's to me, it's all about consent and it's about, you know, open source. So like to me, if someone wants to consent to yield information about themselves in exchange for trust, like why would we forbid that? You know, like, right? Like, it's like, I would like to get the value of me telling a specific party about myself. And it's like, great, knock yourself out, right? There's not, we shouldn't forbid it. So this has been a super awesome conversation. Really, welcome back anytime. And you know, thanks for joining the show.
Awesome. Thank you, Miko, for having me. This was just a lot of fun.
Excellent. We'll do it again.